Welcome. This is the Fly Fishing Journeys podcast with host Rob Giannino, where we have great conversation with really awesome experts from within the fly fishing community. You see, the fly fishing lifestyle is a journey, and we're glad you're on this journey with us. Check out flyfishingjourneys.com for more podcasts, and please subscribe on your favorite podcast player. Here's your host, Rob Giannino.
In this episode, we learn about the process of making custom fly rods. My guest is Joel Dube, co-owner of Tom Morgan Rodsmiths. If you've ever wondered how fly rods are crafted, especially custom handmade fly rods, you're going to love this episode. Joel and fellow co-owner Matt Barber learn the process of making high-quality custom fly rods from the late Tom Morgan. Tom was the lead fly rod designer for R.L. Winson for many years before starting his own small-batch custom fly rod company. Unfortunately, Tom passed in July of 2017. Joel does an amazing job sharing about Tom's passion and legacy in this episode. The spirit of those passions is carried forth in Tom Morgan Rodsmiths. Thanks to our sponsors. Bissell Insurance Agency has been insuring the fishing industry for over 30 years. They currently have over 5,600 clients throughout the U.S. They provide insurance coverage for fly shops, fishing lodges, guides, outfitters, manufacturers, and pretty much anything fishing industry related. You can find them at BisselInsuranceAgency.com. Are you in the market for a new fly tying vise or maybe looking to add a rotary vise to your tying bench? Check out our friends at Norvice. They're at all the fly fishing shows as well as a host of others. You can find details about this fantastic vise and their show schedule online at nor-vise.com. Speaking of the shows, you can find all the details to the nationwide fly fishing show tour at flyfishingshow.com. If you're coming to any of the 7 fly fishing shows, be sure to stop by the Fly Fishing Journeys podcast booth. We'd love to say hello. Now let's get to the pod.
We are here live with Joel Dube, and we are excited because he is a co-owner along with Matt Barber of Tom Morgan Rodsmiths. And we're going to dive into how to make a rod. You guys have both graphite and bamboo rods.
And glass.
Yep. And a small batch, and they're custom to order. Mm-hmm. So we're going to talk about how you go ahead and make a custom rod. So first, Joel, thanks for being on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Where are you guys located?
We're in Bozeman, Montana. Trout country.
Tough section of the world.
Yeah, there's very little places to fish there, yeah.
Bozeman, okay. And what's neat about having a rod building company there in Bozeman?
Well, the product development environment's pretty good.
Yeah, yeah.
Testing. We don't get to test as much as we'd like, but yeah, it's certainly a lot of history in Bozeman. Feel connected a lot to the West and the lore of trout fishing there, and have the opportunity to share experiences and develop products there that are really designed for trout fishing. We only make trout rods. Our focus really is to make the best trout rod we possibly can make, and Tom Morgan's lineage is as a fishing guide in the area, and his focus was on trout fishing in Montana. So we make rods that are great for spring creeks. We make rods that are good for big western rivers. Your casting streamers, battling wind, and catching fish that are, you know, pretty large on average. Yeah.
The name Tom Morgan obviously has a huge history in fly fishing and rod design. Can you give our listeners a background who may not know Tom, his history, how he came and connected with RL, and then obviously moved on to start Tom Morgan Rodsmith?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things I've learned, and we certainly are early in the learning process for us, about rod design is the advantage that people have as they get into rod design. And as I mentioned, Tom's lineage was as a fishing guide. So his history was watching people fish in Montana and kind of looking at the things that his clients struggle with. And for the most part, what that involved was being accurate with flies, having soft presentations with flies, and hooking and landing fish consistently. Those were kind of the three areas that he saw people were deficient in. So he designed rods really to address those challenges. And I think there's different ways to arrive as a rod designer. Some people are more scientifically oriented or mechanically engineering oriented, where they look at resins and strength to weight ratios, and you know, they have a different approach. And those people tend to, it's a generalization for sure, but they tend to fall into two camps. You can kind of be more of a butt of the rod designer, where you're looking more at kind of power and distance, or you can be more of a tip-first designer, where you look at what the function of the tip is and how it works in casting accuracy presentation. Tom was a tip-first designer. He certainly told us on one of the first days we met him, you know, that when he designs rods, the tip to him was the most important part of the rod because it played the biggest role in accuracy, presentation, protecting tippets, and catching fish. So for him, that's how he started. And there are other people that focus more on distance, and certainly in some applications, like salt water, distance is more important. and the fish are bigger and the flies are bigger. And maybe the tip isn't as important in protecting heavier tippets and bigger flies.
Interesting.
But with trout fishing, for us, that's where we start when we design a rod.
Interesting.
Is to really think about how you make the softest tip we can to ensure that you have the most success trout fishing.
I want to rewind here because I know Tom has his history in design. So can you give our listeners kind of a rewind, maybe back to the early 70s, what Tom was doing and then his process through R.L. Winston and then obviously into Tom Morgan Rodsmith?
Yeah, and so I'm sure listeners out there probably know more about this than I do, actually. But, you know, in 1973, Tom and a business partner, after about 20 years or so of guiding in West Yellowstone area, Tom and a business partner purchased R.L. Winston when they were in San Francisco and kept them there for a couple years, moved them to Twin Bridges, Montana shortly thereafter. Tom was a Montana kid, and you know, you think about the lore and the history of the fishing rivers in the area and trout fishing there in general, I think they want to be closer to it. You know, I think that there is something about being embedded with what you do that makes the products better. And so I think that was the big drive. And then he brought on a partner named Glenn Brackett, who really worked on the bamboo side of the business. And that was around the time, you know, mid-70s, early 80s, was when graphite really became a common material in fly rods. And so Tom really drove graphite's adoption with Winston, as well as his obsession with quality. So, you know, I think in some ways he's credited with a vast improvement in the quality of fly rods across the industry, because he became really well known that they were colloquially referred to as green sticks when they started making graphite rods at Winston. And I think that many people aspirationally, guides and fishermen, wanted a green stick.
Sure.
And that became kind of the euphemism. And Tom really looked at what the product was in the early 70s and said, this product could be so much better if we focused on some key details when we make fly rods.
Tell me a bit about R.L. Winston, because I mean, that name that has signifies the quality. What really separates R.L. Winston while Tom was working through there in the 70s and 80s and 90s that made that aura around R.L. the rod to have?
Yeah, well, I grew up fishing Winston. So, I, you know, when I was 13, I mowed lawns for a summer and bought a Winston rod at the end of the year. And so I grew up on Winston rods. But I think, you know, from my perspective, what they're known for is, number one, they're beautiful. I mean, they have a beautiful finish, a translucent green finish. You can see the raw material of the graphite underneath. The cork was nicer. The reel seats were prettier. The hardware was maybe slightly smaller in scale. It had a delicate, maybe isn't the right word, but it had a fineness to it that was a little different than other rods that were in the marketplace. A more moderate action fly rod, not a super fast fly rod. So they demanded a little more when you cast them, but gave you more feedback and more information.
Before we dive in, because I'm really excited for you to take us through how you build a rod from blank all the way to finish, and you're going to walk us through that, Joel, so I'm so excited for that. But before we do that, talk about why Tom moved from RL to his own Rodsmith's company.
Sure. So I think after 20 some years of running a large production rod company, I think there are challenges when you're in a volume environment. And there are times when you may have to sacrifice the way you'd like to do things because you have numbers that you need to make. Certainly managing employees comes with its own challenges. So, you know, there are headaches that come along with being in a production environment with investors and all that stuff. And so I think Tom felt that he had moved away from what his passion was. He wasn't fishing as much. He couldn't make a rod exactly the way he would make a rod if he was just making one or two a year.
Mm-hmm.
And so he actually sold it to the current ownership and stayed on for quite a while, almost 5 years, kind of helping them, you know, adopt the philosophies and learn really about the company and how he viewed rod production. And shortly thereafter, unfortunately, developed MS and pretty quickly went to a state where he couldn't walk and then was paralyzed.
Mm.
So I think for them, it was a challenge of what can we do to keep us together, have a caretaker, and still leverage Tom's enormous experience in the industry.
Mm.
And so Tom had always wanted to make the perfect trout rod. He always wanted to make a rod regardless of how long it took to make, regardless of how long it cost. He didn't want to have ad hoc pricing to get the best stripping guide or get the kind of wood you wanted. He wanted to have the best of everything and roll that all in and make a rod that was really his ultimate trout rod. And interestingly enough, I don't know that he ever made what he considered the ultimate trout rod. It's one of those goals.
It was challenged.
Yeah, it's one of those goals that keeps you going.
Sure.
Right? To always be improving, always be tinkering. It's aspirational in nature.
That's awesome.
To make the perfect trout rod.
And so then Tom Morgan Rodsmith was developed.
Yes. So then they started the rods. And so Tom made his own designs, slightly different from Winston. Still in the same mold of having a feel first, accuracy first, soft tip kind of characteristic. And he looked for who he thought was the very best maker of nickel silver reel seat hardware, and designed his own hardware to his own dimensions for the reel seats. And who makes the very best stripper? I went to that guy and said, I like your strippers, but I want this to be different on them, so they're for my rods. You know, and really looked at what the different philosophies were and utilized a pretty large vendor network to have the very best of each component you could have for a fly rod.
And so how did you and Matt come to own the company?
Since I was an early teenager, I knew about Tom Morgan, right? So yeah. I owned Winston Fly Rods and, you know, through college, fished them pretty extensively and exclusively, and knew a bit about Tom Morgan Rodsmiths and would occasionally surf the webpage and tell my wife, gosh, I got to get some of these rods before they're gone, right? And never did, of course. And they had put a notice on their website. So I was in the process of being in a career for about 15 years that had, for various reasons, kind of burnt out for me, and I had some friends who were in a similar situation. Denver was growing really quickly, and we were all kind of thinking, you know, where's the next place we can go where we have more space and more access and more time to be outside? And it all kind of congealed with contacting Tom for the first time. And so I started talking to him a little bit. We took a trip to Bozeman, and Bozeman's a pretty special place if you haven't been there. You know, really great culture, outdoor culture, you know, opportunities year-round to be outside enjoying nature. And the access to fishing, obviously, is phenomenal, and the access to skiing is phenomenal, and all the things you'd want as a young family. And so went there, the town checked boxes, went to meet Tom, and he has a beautiful house up on a hill, and you kind of make this pilgrimage out. You're looking at the Spanish Peaks. It's this beautiful vista, and you meet a legendary person in fly fishing that you've kind of known about and known of for so long, and it's hard not to be seduced in a way by that environment, you know, and talking to Tom. And so we pretty quickly decided it was something we were interested in, and then spent about another 9 months really on weekly calls, with Tom and Jerry, talking about the business, really doing diligence, figuring out how we would do things. And I think for them, the match for them really was that we didn't want to take Tom Morgan's name and put it on a rod that was made overseas and slap it in every fly shop in America.
Right.
We wanted to move to Bozeman and learn how to make rods and continue making the way Tom did.
Yeah.
Yep. And make it a family, kind of a family business, and something we really wanted to be invested in and involved in. Yep.
And how long has he now been passed?
He passed July a year and a half ago.
Yeah, it's sad.
After a quick battle with pneumonia. He always said if he got pneumonia, that's how it would go. But an amazing man. And I think we think about a lot with Tom is his two things, really: his positivity and his mental ability. As his physical ability is diminished, his mental ability increased.
Interesting.
And I think we talk about that. You hear about blind people who can hear more, you know, all these different senses kind of take a more predominant role. But Tom was able, from his bed, to design one of two ways to make a bamboo rod in the world with the Morgan handmill. Never used it, never touched it. So he conceptualized this thing in his brain. And when you're quadriplegic, using a computer isn't easy. Tom also was volumic in his writings. And so you're using voice recognition software that maybe 60% accurate. You know, for him to click on an icon on a computer screen was usually about a 30-second to 1-minute process. One click. You know, and I remember sitting by his bedside and saying, doesn't this drive you crazy? Like, when you see this, you just, as a person with me, like me, I just want to take the keyboard and do it. And he said, you know what? I tried being frustrated by it, and it didn't work out very well for me. You know, so his acceptance, not only of his condition, but his ability to translate what he could do and do more of what he could do, was pretty inspiring.
Well, that's a lesson for all of us.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Because I have my limitations, and they're quite apparent.
Right.
But
I don't see any of them.
I appreciate that. They're very apparent. Ask my wife. But, you know, we all have gifts and abilities.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of times people say, you know, some people say focus on your weaknesses and improve them. Other people say just really get good at what you're good at and don't worry about your weaknesses.
Yeah, I'm a strength builder guy.
Yeah. Yep. Build your strengths and then subcontract your weaknesses.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's talk about how we go ahead and build a rod.
Sure.
You start from a blank, and why don't you talk a little bit about, you know, you guys are small production, so really customized for the customer.
Sure.
That customer can pick all their components, and they're going to get the rod that they want.
Yep.
But for some reason, you know, for different reasons, you don't necessarily go ahead and build those blanks yourself in-house, but you have somebody do that to your specs.
Yeah. So what we can talk about a little bit is, so first of all, our model is a little different in that somebody walks up to our booth and says, I want a rod today. We have to tell them it's 6 months to get their rod. So we don't make rods until somebody orders a rod. So we're a little different in that way. And I think one of the things that's really rewarding for us is I owned a lot of rods. I never knew anybody that made my rod. Didn't really even know anybody at the factory at Winston, right? So we have a unique opportunity to talk to every one of our customers. And I think the ability to connect with people and talk about where they fish, how they fish, what they want, you know, all those things make it more meaningful.
Mm-hmm.
When you you get a rod. It makes that weight a little bit more palatable because we're talking to them the whole time about the grip or about the wood that they want or, you know, all the different things that we're doing with the rod. And it kind of builds a sense of anticipation in our customers.
Yeah.
And when they get it, they're excited. They're excited. We're super excited to get it to them, you know. And all of our rods, when we make them in our board where we track where the rods are in the rod making process, they're all called by the person's name. So it's not the 9'5" weight. It's the king rod, you know, or it's the reed rod or, you know, we'll say to each other all the time, like, where's the reed rod? What's going on with the reed rod today? Or, you know, is that thing ready? Or how are you ready to move the next? So there is a personalization that comes with each rod, and they kind of take on a bit of a personality. But, you know, when we make rods, one of the things that was important to us is to continue to make all three types of materials. So we make graphite, bamboo, and fiberglass rods. And I think, you know, part of that is just homage to Tom, but also the fact that the different materials really suit different conditions. Mm. And depending on how you fish, and we talk a lot about when people are choosing materials, not only what type of fish they're fishing for, but how they fish. You know, and a four weight might be a perfect rod for out west, depending how you fish. Or if you're just going to fish the spring creeks in Montana, a four weight's great. If you're just going to fish big freestone rivers like the Yellowstone, six weight's going to be a much better choice.
Right.
You know, and so it's not even only the size of fish, it's the type of fishing and the water that you're using the rod in. And so for us, you know, graphite is certainly a predominance of our business, and that's the predominance of the fly rod market now. But we sell a fair amount of bamboo and glass as well. And so our customer base tends to be people that own multiple fly rods already and are experienced fishermen. And so a lot of times they're looking for niche things like glass or bamboo.
Yeah.
And then so having that is really important to us. And so when we make fly rods, not to jump ahead too much, when we make bamboo, we actually start with a raw comb or section of bamboo from Tonkin, China, and we split the bamboo into smaller strips, mill them, and fasten and join them, glue them, treat them, everything from scratch. So that would be an example in bamboo where we make the blank from scratch.
Yeah.
With fiberglass and graphite, it's a bit different process. And so it's more of an industrial process with machines, whereas bamboo is almost all hand done. And we actually contract that out. We don't, unfortunately, have the ability to roll our own blanks right now, something you're certainly aspirationally would like to do in the next, you know, few years. But we actually contract that out. So what we do is we ship the pattern, we'll talk about pattern more in a little bit, and the mandrels, we'll talk about those as well, to a contractor who makes them for us. And one of the challenges of being a small rod maker certainly is blank supply, and when you're a small rod maker, you don't have a lot of volume. And so big machining companies that do this type of work on golf shafts and other things, their minimum numbers are much bigger than what we would ever be able to use. And so for us, we have to, you know, look creatively around the country to find smaller manufacturers or people that have the capacity to do small numbers of blanks. And so basically the way a blank manufacturing works, there are a couple specialized machines that are part of the process, but you start with a fabric. And so when we talk about fabric, we're talking about glass or graphite. And fabric's kind of just a colloquialism for the scrim. Some people call it scrim, some people call it prepreg, another term that you'll hear in the industry. And essentially what you do is you have a roll of this fabric, it's kept refrigerated, and it's sort of semi-flexible. The refrigeration makes the resin in the fabric last longer. And all trout rods are based on a pattern. Same thing with bamboo trout rods. We call them tapers with bamboo. And the pattern essentially looks like a sailcloth. So it's broader on one end, which is the butt end, and narrower on the other end, which is the tip end. And the way that you get from the broad section to the tip section is really where most of the secret sauce is in fly rod design. Some people do a constant taper. Some people do compound tapers. There are parabolic tapers. There's all different ways to treat that pattern. But essentially what you do is you take the pattern and you cut it out of the fabric. And so you're left with a piece of graphite or fiberglass that has a certain shape to it, usually vaguely triangular in shape. Right?
Interesting.
Yep. And then you take a mandrel. So a mandrel is a long cylindrical piece of steel that has a preset taper in it. That taper could be 30 thousandths per inch, let's say. And you lay out that mandrel on the leading edge of the cloth pattern, and you take a heating iron, you basically tack it. So it actually tacks the fabric onto the mandrel. And then there's a machine with some human assistance, so there's actually human interplay here, that rolls the mandrel onto the fabric. And so you end up with the fabric rolled around this mandrel that has a certain taper. So the combination of the shape of the cloth, the taper and size of the mandrel is really what creates the action of a blank. And it could be a stiffer blank, it could be a butt-heavy blank, tip-heavy blank, a medium action saw. All those things are really in the way you design that pattern. And so that wraps on there, and then they go to a cellophane machine. It's basically tape, very narrow tape, and they roll that on top of the pattern, on top of the mandrel, under pressure. and then they hang it in an oven and bake it, and the combination of the pressure and the tape cures the resin in the fabric, and that's what makes it hard.
That's so descriptive and so awesome for our listeners.
Yep. And then lastly, it comes out, and there's a thing called mandrel puller that pulls the mandrel out, and you're left with the hollow tube of graphite or fiberglass.
Very cool. Yep. And so that's your blank.
That's the blank. Yep.
That's really descriptive.
And then most of the time, you're going to sand off the cellophane. Mm-hmm. Most rods are made with, they put it in a machine sander, it sands off the cellophane, and then when we get them, we actually hand prep them to make sure all the cellophane resin is gone.
And so you start with that. And so that secret sauce is really what determines the, you know, the quality differences, the style, the action, and what separates different rod manufacturers.
For sure.
And then the rest of it too. But that's really cool. How do you determine the difference between like a 6 and an 8 and a 9 and a 2?
It's all of it. And, you know, there are engineering standards for line weights. And so if you look at the engineering standards for line weights, grain weights, you know, the line grain weights for a 2 weight versus a 6 weight, there's percentage differences between the classes. And so when you're designing rods, you actually can design truly to the standard and look at things like flag shape and things like that. And you reduce them by the appropriate percentages to make a 6 versus a 5 or a 5 versus a 4.
Or fast versus distance.
Yep. Absolutely. Yep. You can make fast versus slow, accurate versus distance. I mean, all those things kind of come into play.
And just kind of how you fix that triangular shape and millimeters. So that's pretty cool. Well, I'm glad our listeners got to know a little bit more about designing a blank. Now, once you have that blank, what's next?
Yeah. So, you know, the interesting thing for us, and certainly one of the things we've learned, is there is a certain amount of, I hate to say human error, handmadeness to blanks, maybe is a better way to say it. So when we get blanks, we bend every single blank we get. It's called deflection. So the first thing you do when you get blanks is you deflect them. So you hang a standardized size weight on it, and you have a board. And we know for us that a 5 weight should deflect with a certain gram of weight to a certain inches that we measure on the board. And so we measure every single one of them to make sure they're deflecting or bending appropriately. If they don't bend it within a certain range of our target, then we have to reject them. So, and that can happen. They certainly can happen. The other thing we look at with blanks is we look down the blanks. They're very rarely perfectly straight.
So we're rolling them like a pool cue before you get in a big match.
Exactly,
here.
Exactly. Except we have ways to straighten them, and you might not before you
get a match. No, no. We just put that one back on the wall and get another one.
So if it passes deflection and we can straighten it enough to make it perfectly straight, then we actually start using it for a rod. So there's a couple things it has to pass. Yep. And then certainly coating. So then we coat the blanks. Coating on rod blanks is really intended to add some protection to the raw material, and then it can be decorative as well. So we want it to be beautiful. So we actually coat the rods as well. So at any stage in there, we, as a small manufacturer, we want to take every single blank we can get and make a rod out of it.
Yeah.
You know, that's kind of our goal.
Right.
And so we do everything we can to save them. But at any point in that process, they could fail. You know, they could be too stiff. They could be too soft. They could not be straight enough for us to correct them. They could have blips or damage in the coating. You know, any of those
things
along
the way.
What's the coating? It's essentially, it's a...
a resin?
Yeah, it's a resin coating. Goes on very, very thin. And so we actually do that in-house now. It's one of the lessons we certainly learned is, you know, the more the process you can control as a manufacturer, the better the results will be.
Yeah.
Or the more the results will be what you want them to be.
Sure.
I guess is a better way to say it. So that's one of the things we spent about a year and a half working on was coating. We just couldn't get the color that we wanted with the quality we wanted. And so we actually had to teach ourselves. And we're lucky that to have advice from some very, very qualified and experienced people that basically said, you know, you have to figure it out yourself if that's really what you want.
Now that you have that blank, what's next in the process?
So then you have the blank, and the next thing we do is we actually look at farrowing the rod. And farrowing essentially is that you're cutting the rod into 2 or 4 pieces for us. And so you look at where you're going to make the joints in the rod, and you cut it down to the specific size that the rod's going to become.
So for 4-piece, you got to cut it in 4 pieces.
Yep, exactly right.
Very carefully.
Yes, very carefully, and you measure twice, cut once.
Okay.
Yep. And then so what we do is we use what's called a spigot farrow. It's a little less common type of a farrow. There's the most common farrow you'll see is what's called a tip-over or a sleeve-over farrow. There's some advantages to that. It's a little bit less onerous to make a sleeve-over farrow. You roll the blank in 4 pieces if you're making a 4-piece sleeve-over. Our blanks are 2 pieces because we do 2 or 4. And for us, without a rolling facility, we don't want to make a whole lot of blanks. We want to make as few blanks as we can and adapt them. A spigot farrow essentially means you chop the blank, and then you use a piece of either graphite or fiberglass to span the joint. And the advantage of spigot is you get to save or preserve the taper of the rod across the joint, theoretically leading to a smoother transition and more natural preservation of action. They just take more time. There's a fair amount of dry fitting. And so the process of making a spigot for us might take 3 days. The process of making a sleeve over for a major manufacturer might take 2 hours. You know, so that there's differences in how long it takes. And we don't make a lot of rods, so we tend to choose the process that we think gives the very, very, very best result.
The highest quality,
yeah.
And so now you get your rod in amount of pieces that you need.
So yep,
you get
so
your
felled
four,
it.
You
yep.
felled it, you get your four-piece rod.
Yep. And it's time to put the handle on it. So we look at handles. When we make a handle, we actually take cork, the very best cork we can get. It's a funny story. Tom wouldn't tell us who his cork supplier was until the ink was dry on the paperwork
by
the
funny.
Company. Yeah. Cork is becoming exceedingly hard to get, especially high-grade cork. And so we buy the very best cork we can. And one of the worst jobs in our shop, I'd say, is the cork sorting job. So we didn't know this, but cork comes in about 8 different colors and shades. And so for us, when we make a handle, we don't want a dark cork next to a light cork, next to a rose cork, next to a brown cork, because you get stripes. And so for us, we sort 13 cork to look for uniformity of color. And that's how we make a handle. And it's a giant sorting board with pegs that stick up out of it. And so you sit there and move cork back and forth and sort until you get uniformity of color. And then we actually individually drill the rings to match the taper of the rod and then pound them on using a pneumatic pounder. And so Tom felt like the attachment between the grip and the blank was essential, and it should be as tight and firm as possible so the motion translates to your hand. And there's no distance or, you know, dampening effect between the handle and the blank. And so we actually pound the cork on individually and then shape them by hand on a lathe to make the grips. And so we can make kind of any shape and size of grip. If it's your grandpa's favorite fly rod grip, or, you know, or we make a standard Western cigar and a full Wells, we kind of start from there. But yeah, we make all different kinds of grips because we make them one at a time.
Yeah, and Matt was even saying that he gets and sands the
sure.
grips
so the way
down.
We shape them with strips of sandpaper. Yeah, we use 6 different grains of sandpaper. So the last two are really kind of sealing and making a very, very smooth finish. And it's pretty intuitive. It's one of the more fun jobs. I say sorting cork because it's kind of the more monotonous jobs. But shaping is pretty interesting because the more you pull, the more you take away. And a lot of times what we do, we don't really caliper them anymore. You just hold it with your hand as it's spinning on the lathe, and you get a feeling for how wide or narrow it needs to be to feel like the right grip for us. Yep.
So what's next? The reel seat?
No, guides.
Oh, the guides.
Yep. So then you take them and you mark the guide spacing on them and wrap the guides on. We use an old Gutabrod thread for our guides. So we wrap them on. And that's really the same process for all the rods now is handles and guides. Bamboo for us is a little tricky because we make two-tip rods. And so for us, the two tips have to match exactly. And so wrapping the first tip with the guides is pretty easy, but then wrapping the second tip might take 4 times as long because you're trying to mirror exactly where the guides are on the first tip. And so we
Incredible.
Use calipers to measure and count the wraps and make sure everything is exactly the same. Because for us, a bamboo rod, the tips should be indistinguishable. And that's not only the wraps, but the level of coating and everything on them. So after the wraps go on them, we generally have our calligrapher come and she will write the inscription on the rod. And people choose, you know, we often put Tom Morgan Rodsmith on there, but people choose Latin sayings or, you know.
Their last name?
Yeah, last name's very common, first initial last name. We just built a rod that said Obi-Wan Kenobi on it for somebody who's a Star Wars fan.
Wow.
And so that's pretty typical. Some inscription, the model of the rod, and then the serial number for us. And we do the serial number, I didn't mention this, so when we deflect blanks, we record every deflection. So if somebody were to break a tip, we can go back by their serial number and pick that tip and know what the deflection was and look for a deflection that's similar so we can match the rod and it has really the same characteristic.
That's incredible.
Yep.
So now that we have our ferrules, we have our handle,
yep.
we have our guides.
Yep, so they go in the coating room then.
Coating room.
Yep, and so we put a flexible epoxy coat on the guides. And what that does is really cement the guides in place. It wets out the thread becomes a little bit darker. These are all really hand-done processes. So for us, we essentially chuck the rod on a rotating motor. And we use paintbrushes and apply consecutive coats, many consecutive coats of flat, flexible epoxy to protect the rod.
Yeah. Okay, and then what's the next process?
Then it comes out of there, it comes to the area we call finishing. And that's really where you're doing, you're attaching the reel seat. We do all our final inspection there, and most of our coating and inspection is done under magnification. So we use magnifying glasses to make sure that we're looking for any kind of dust specks in the coating, any kind of irregularities in the blank coating, anything like that. And then we're buffing, sanding and buffing under, you know, really fine conditions to make sure the rod's as perfect as it can be. Attach the reel seat, final polishing, final inspection there, and then it goes in the tube and the case, and it's ready to go.
It's a beautiful tube, too. I saw over at your booth and just the quality there. And I know what's neat kind of for the customers, they can, like, checkmark different things, what handle they want, what style of handle, the reel seat, how it looks, and different wood ingrains. And tell us a little bit about the finishing process for you guys.
Sure. So I think that's kind of I always complain. There's a little bit of pressure there because you want the rod to be as good as it can be. And one of the things we learned from Tom is kind of the key to making rods the way we do is kind of this fanatical adherence to quality and the ability to say at the very end of that process, there's something wrong with the rod that we can't fix and you have to start over. And so that's one of the harder things we do is throw away rods that are pretty okay but aren't good enough for us. They either have a scratch somewhere along the process, they got dropped, dinged, you know, something's wrong with them, and we have to actually say to the customer, look, you know, your rod's going to be remade. And sometimes that means we send them a rod and make them a new one, and they fish that while they're waiting for it. Sometimes it means they have to wait longer to get any rod. And that's a hard thing to do, especially as a small business, because every rod is meaningful.
Sure.
And to actually say, you know, this isn't going to meet our standards. And Tom always talked to us about the fact that your work, your very, very best work and your very worst work should be really close together.
You know,
the gap between the two shouldn't be very much. And so that's one of the things we have to do at the end there that's tough to stomach sometimes.
Well, yeah, and then I know a customer can actually have some, what can you pick for differences in like the wheel seat?
So Tom was a bit of a wood collector, and so we've ended up with quite a collection of hardwoods, and we work probably with about 17 or 18 different hardwoods, and so we give people the choice of the actual wood that becomes their seat. We send them the selections of the turn seats, and they can pick them, which for some people is a long process, and we send them 3 or 4 selections of 8 real seats. Some people say, you guys pick, I just want a dark seat or a light seat.
Right.
And so that's one of the things they can certainly pick. And then we still make 3 styles of real seats. We make down lock, up lock, and slide bands too.
And then also some different metals or different anodized?
Sure, yeah, we can do black anodized hardware. Sometimes on bamboo, there's some people that like the black anodized hardware. We actually had somebody in Hawaii that fishes in New Zealand quite a bit, and he wanted a stealth rod. You know, he wanted everything to be not chrome. And so we were actually able to do a coating on all of the parts that was a matte coating.
Well, that's really neat. So are you right in Bozeman now?
Yeah. Yes, we're in Bozeman. Yep.
Yeah. And, well, that's awesome. And yourself, you live right in Bozeman?
We do. We do. Yep. Yep. We live right in town. Matt and I both live down there, and it's been really great. It's a really fun family town.
Well, good. It's been an honor to have you on our podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me. Yeah,
it's been really fun. And how many of the shows are you doing, all 7 shows?
Not all of them. No, I think we'll do 5 this year.
5, okay.
Yep.
Well, Joel, why don't you give our listeners a way to get a hold of you, or maybe your website, or how they can find out more about Tom Morgan?
Yeah, so certainly one of our favorite things is doing tours at the shop. So we have a lot of people that come through in the summertime for fishing. And, you know, we're a small business, so we always say call or contact us before to make sure we're around. But, yeah, happy to do tours if people want to see kind of how the soup's made. And the tour can be 15 minutes or an hour and a half, depending on what you want to learn and how in-depth you want to get with it. But, you know, we're a pretty open door, and we'd love to help people who are amateur builders or just want to see how a rod's made. They're certainly welcome to stop by the shop. And so we're in Bozeman, Montana, right off the highway on 7th Avenue. Certainly the website is troutrods.com or tommorganrodsmiths.com. Tons of information on there as well, and our contact too.
Yeah, before we close, Joel, you also have a rod building workshop?
Sure, we do. So we do bamboo rod building classes. As I mentioned earlier, Tom kind of invented a planing system for making bamboo strips for fly rods. And so we do a couple classes. I think we'll do 5 this year, actually, and those dates are on the website. Where you come in on a Sunday afternoon, we start with splitting cane, work cane for a couple days, and you actually end up leaving Friday afternoon with a rod you've made. So it's a little different process than we actually do with our production bamboo rods because of our condensed time frame. But
right.
The rods have turned out great. It's been pretty rewarding for people. So, you know, we always say it's really fun to catch a fish on a fly you made, and I think it's even more rewarding to catch a fish on a rod you made.
Well, think about that, too, because a lot of people may not want to take on that task of building a rod mm-hmm. all by themselves, because it's a huge undertaking if you don't know what you're doing.
Sure.
But if you can actually do it, but under the guidance of a workshop, how cool would that be?
Yeah, certainly shortens the learning curve, I think. Yeah, you get some pretty intense tutelage. And we certainly have had people that have gone out of that class and said, I did it once, I made my rod, I'm done. And we've had a fair amount of people that say, I'm going to set up a shop in my backyard and start actually making bamboo friends and family. Or people that even say, I'm going to become a bamboo rod builder and sell them. And this is how I'm going to kind of jumpstart that idea.
How neat would that be? Yeah, so that's cool. Joel, thank you for being on our podcast.
Great, thanks for having me.
And maybe I'll have to get out there and see a tour of the place.
Mm-hmm. Yep, just don't wear your Patriots cap.
Oh, ouch. Then you can't get in?
I don't know. Admission policy's tricked on that.
It's debatable.
Uh-huh.
Thanks, Joel.
All right, cool, thanks.
You've been listening to Fly Fishing Journeys with your host, Rob Giannino. To be notified of new episodes, subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, or Google Podcasts. You can follow us on YouTube, Facebook, and Instagram. For past episodes, check out flyfishingjourneys.com. Fly fishing is a journey, and we're glad you're on this journey with us.